Welcome to Walk the Talk, with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. Jackie Moulton was born and raised in Leicestershire and joined her local police force as a cadet. Later on, she transferred to London's Metropolitan Police. From the outset, Jackie was openly gay when many of her peers were unable to cross that line and remained in the closet. Jackie rose through the ranks and became a detective inspector on the Met's flying squad. Her passion for the job and her refusal to conform to the institution took its toll. Jackie became an alcoholic, and it was a chance meeting with fellow alcoholics that was to change her life forever. As a proven thief taker, Jackie would always ask why people committed crime, when her colleagues would be asking how. Now retired, Jackie gained several degrees and is now counselling inmates in prisons on their own reasons for committing crime. Many of them are serving life for murder. You would think Jackie would be the last person to see offenders as victims, but when you hear her experiences through the work she has done, you can't help to be moved by the stories she shares. Jackie's love for life and people is infectious, and she is a force of nature. You may not have heard of Jackie Moulton, but you will have heard of the character Linda LaPlante based her fictional character on. Prime Suspect was broadcast in the 1990s, and D.I. Jane Tennyson was born from Jackie's own story. I'm delighted to say that Jackie has agreed to share her story with me. So join us now as we walk around her local village with her dog Stanley.
So you join us on Thursley Common, which is in the county of Surrey, on a very crisp, sunny Saturday morning. I'm with Stanley, who's a Laitland Terrier, and also joined by his only owner, Jackie Moulton. So welcome to Walk the Talk, Jackie.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to meet you.
So the first obvious question that I have to ask you is, why did you become a police officer?
I was the youngest of three growing up in Leicester, and I failed the 11 plus when everybody else passed it in my family. So there was kind of what I would think, well, it was, it's a great shame actually about this failure. Went to secondary modern school, which was fine, absolutely fine. It was tomboys, do a lot of sports and stuff. Topics that I was most interested in were English and history, and I was particularly interested in the Industrial Revolution. I don't know why. I was interested in prison reform, I don't know why, but I was at that time. And I was always fascinated about why people did the things that they did. And in retrospect, I now know what that was, because I was trying to find out about myself. It's a very deep unconscious level. And so I really wanted to be either probation or do psychology. And I wasn't going to do that because I wasn't going to go to university. And I thought, I know, I'll be a police officer. So the purpose was to primarily help people. That was my primary purpose, was to help people, yeah. Really. You know, and it's a decision I made. I joined the police cadets in Leicester, and it was the right thing for me to do. I loved it.
Well, I know when we discussed this earlier, you said you were sort of drawn to the darkness of the job. What did you mean by that?
Because I was very interested in people. I always have been. My mum would say to me when I was little, oh, you get people to tell them all sorts of things, Jackie. I don't know. I think that's absolutely true, because people say to me still to this day, why is it that when I'm with you, I tell you everything about myself and I don't really know you, type of thing. So that, I knew I had that. And the thing about the communication, because everybody has a story, so all of us, we have a beginning and middle and an end. And so the police were interested in, obviously, because we're police officers, did you commit, or did you break that window?
Hmm.
Yay or nay? And they go, yay or nay, whatever it was. And I also just wanted to ask the questions, why did you break that window?
Yes.
Because that's the bigger question. And those things like, because my stepfather was been sexually abusing me.
Mm.
So the bigger questions would reveal more. And my experience is that people don't just commit crime, you know, spontaneously. They all have stories. And of course, I'm in a prison now and I listen to their stories, you know, twice a week, listen to their childhoods and stuff. So when I'm in When I said I was interested in the dark side, I was also interested in something, you know, that was within me. And I look back now and I just kind of think we all find a ministry in life, and that's my ministry. My ministry is that I wanted to be... I was interested in criminology and criminals. I was always interested in prisons, but I didn't want to particularly be a prison officer. That's why I joined the police. I wasn't keen on locking people up in that respect.
Yeah.
But if somebody said to me, "Oh, Jackie, you will be in a prison, but it will be through, you've earned your seat through your own alcoholism to be in a prison," you know, I'd have just looked at them as if to say, but that was the journey.
Yeah.
I am in a prison, but my route was a bit different to get there.
Yeah. Well, I think I've spoken to a few people that are passionate about what they do, and there's a theme that runs through a few of the stories, and that they say that they were almost running away from something. I was just wondering if your career choice, where you were running away from something.
I was running towards something. I think it's the opposite, but I didn't know what it was that I was running towards.
Uh-huh.
I do now, but I didn't know then. So I think it was an unconscious running towards to try and find out that if I started to understand these people, then I would understand myself.
Yeah. And I know you've done a lot of work in prisons, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. But I'm just wondering, dealing with convicts, ex-convicts, whether there's any common themes between being a police officer and a criminal, I suppose.
In their kind of... I think there is something about that thought process that criminals are quite devious. A lot of them, I think, are above average intelligence. I know they get caught and everything, but they're streetwise. They've got a lot of kind of common sense. They have a sense of intuition. All of these things that police officers do have, common sense, streetwise, intuition and everything else. And it does become a bit of them and us, as we know that. And also, when obviously in the prison they know who I am and stuff about me, and you get calls across, you know, not particularly from my guys, but from other guys in the prison. "Oh, excuse me, miss, are you the one that was in the flying squad?" And you go, "Yeah." "Oh, I got nicked by them." As if there was some accolade to have been arrested by somebody in the flying squad. So they, and also, just in recently about London Bridge or the bombings and everything, they're very, very, very supportive of the police and have huge respect for police. A lot of them have a huge respect for the police and what they do, and they'd say, "Okay, I was caught, fair cop." And they would also say that prison has been the best thing for me in order to kind of look at myself, themselves, to change. Because, you know, people will tell you stories and say, you know, in their 40s, said, I can't live this life anymore. I need to do something about it.
Yeah.
So I found them very respectful of police. I have not heard people blaming the police for ending up in prison. That's not my experience.
Yeah, it's almost as if, as long as they've been caught fair and square, then that seems to be the sort of, you know, that makes it all right, that it was fair that they were caught.
Yeah, and also the whole work about rehabilitation and change is for them to look at their part and what their patterns of behaviours are, not to point the fingers at, you know, the police. Or the judiciary. You say, "Hold on a minute, you know, what was your part in all of this?" In the work that we do in prison, I do break them down in terms of, when I say break them down, we go back to, you know, to the childhood, and we start from looking at thoughts, behaviours and emotions as far back as they can remember. So we deconstruct their identity, because lots of them have masks operating. A lot of them operate on fear. A lot of them say, "Well, what happens if I find my authentic self and I don't like who I am?" And you say, "That's absolutely impossible to do that," because it is your authentic self. And it takes a lot of courage for people, anybody, honestly do a reflective process of themselves and go to the deepest part of themselves. I always draw an analogy. I did it yesterday in the prison. He's a new guy I've got. And it's a bit like a sealed paint tin. and you have to get the screwdriver under the painting and just ease it up, and you go like the beginnings of the openings, and the trust that you have to build up with them for them to reveal who they truly are. Now, you give them that safe environment and the trust and the identification, because we're addicts. I'm an addict, they're an addict, an alcoholic, they're alcoholics. So we've got an identification process right at the very beginning, and it just seems to work. And I only work with men who come to me and say, you know what, Jackie, I'm ready to change my life, can you help me?
Yeah, well, that's a very important point, isn't it? Because unless that person is at the point where they want to change, then it's just a waste of time, really, isn't it?
Complete waste of time. Absolutely complete waste of time. Now, you also have to suss out that they're not doing it because they're going on the parole board or whatever, what their real reasons for change are. But, you know, prisons is a place of rehabilitation. There's some... I'm in a prison near in Surrey, men's prison, obviously, and we've got a fantastic governor, and it's a working prison on the one hand, so they train them to do all sorts of professions, and it's also an educational prison where they do many rehabilitation courses on healthy relationships, anger management courses. They do alcohol and drugs programs, etc. And I am supervised by the criminologist, who's a substance manager, and I talk to him about the work that I do in there as well. So it's a very cohesive, supportive prison, to be perfectly honest. And so when people then talk about, oh, prison's a soft option, prison's not a soft option. There is nothing for them particularly to do in terms of recreation, exercise, etc., etc. So I don't kind of get that when you get these headlines and says, oh, prison's a soft place. Well, you know, it isn't. And if anybody's been in a prison, they'll see. I mean, we're operating in the 21st century where some cells don't have toilets in their cell. They're locked up. They have to call for somebody to unlock them in the middle of the night. People have got ill. The prison's just been shut down recently because of the norovirus, you know, for 3 weeks, spread right through the prison. And I just kind of, you know, I don't get that attitude that prison is a really soft place, because it's absolutely tough, and you're locked up with people that have all sorts of stuff going on for them. You know, it's kind of electric. It's quite charged, fascinating environment, you know, to be in, to be perfectly honest. And my prisoners that I have are mainly lifers coming towards like 2/3 of their sentence, long-term prisoners. I don't have any short-term prisoners that are only in for 6 months or so, because you need quite a bit of work. And one of mine's just been transferred to an open prison, and his father was... he's from Zimbabwe. His father was in a tribe that didn't support the political Mugabes in that day. And he was a young boy. He's the youngest of six sisters. The soldiers came in to his village. His father was burnt alive in front of him. His two of the girls ran away. Just ran on their heels. Four of the other girls were raped and beheaded in front of him, and he was made to be a boy soldier, killing, as he says, hundreds of people when he was 12 13 14. He had a breakdown. Anyway, cut a long story short, he uses alcohol to numb all of this stuff, and he commits a domestic violence offence, and he got quite a severe sentence. He's now doing a university degree. He's been on a healthy relationships programme. I did work with him 18 months, every week. And the key to it all is to actually say, I cannot, you know, nobody's minimising what happened to you in your life. It still happened, but you have to detach from that because you carried it around like a cloak, and also as a kind of a victim which he is a victim, but you have to separate it and say, this happened to your parents, this happened to your sister, but you're here, and alcohol, you know, looking at the effects of alcohol and subsequent relationships with him, and he did it. He actually did it.
And I suppose with something like that, I guess harbouring feelings of guilt, perhaps, is sometimes a block to getting over things.
Well, the harbouring of the feelings of guilt, but most of them have shame, and the other one that they have is fear. Most of them are riddled. They will tell you in the quiet room that we sit in that they're absolutely full of fear. And one guy, again, his father was a notorious armed robber in prison for murder, brought up this on an estate. He said, innately, he said, Jackie, I am not a thief. I am not a thief. I that's not who I am. But in order to survive on that estate, he learnt to fight. He said, I always felt frightened. And he said, I used drink and drugs. And he took somebody's life in a drunken, drug-filled rage. And what he will tell you, or what he told me, is I am, you know, absolutely, you know, full of fear. And all of this is a persona, it's a mask. So you just have to deconstruct. Take the mask off very, very gently. Do the work. It's around shame, guilt, fear. And then start to reconstruct them, so to speak, together. We do it together, obviously. And to find out who they truly are.
Now, you've described all those emotions, and you also mentioned courage a few minutes ago. And you've made no secret of your own sexuality, and you came out as openly gay very early on in your life, and perhaps in an era that perhaps is not as enlightened as it was or it is today. I don't know if you could share a bit about that with us.
Yeah, one of the things that I had was that I don't come from any form of alcoholic family or any form of addiction, but I used to pick up about, well, my mum sometimes, well, quite a lot actually, she's always worried about what other people thought, you know, neighbours and relatives. And as a little kid, I say, it doesn't really matter, Mum, does it, what other people think of us, as long as we're all right. And along the way...
That's quite a wise thing for a little girl to say, that.
Yeah, I felt... But I remember saying to myself, if I put up an umbrella, you know, as a kind of... imagined an umbrella, that this would not perforate through. And it did. And it did. And I internalised that. And I became concerned about what other people thought of me, and that remained for a number of years, and it is crippling, absolutely crippling. So it was the beginning of an external validation. So about being gay, nobody else I knew was gay. In the police, I don't blame them for this. I certainly don't blame them for this at all. But my gay friends in the police, they all stayed in the closet. And I felt shame, absolute shame. Shame is all pervading and guilt is proportional, if you get my meaning. Mm-hmm. So that was the start of, you know, the shame. And drink, you know, the sexuality. I felt really, really ashamed of myself. And yet there's that other strong part of me that wanted to remain true to who I am. But I was torn. It was incongruent. So my journey was one of incongruence, because my outer did not match my inner, because I felt fragile. I felt my inside was a bit like tissue paper, and my external, like my mask, was one of an extrovert, fun girl. But that wasn't who I was. I am an extrovert and a fun girl now, but in a sense, it was a mask that I used in order, you know, to get people to like me and all of that stuff, because I was worried about what other people thought. But when it's an incongruence to who you truly are, because there is part of me that you'll be surprised to know I'm quite shy.
So you weren't, almost you weren't able to live with yourself, I suppose.
It was a terrible feeling of being able to live with yourself. So alcohol took the numbness away. And I was an overfeeler, that was another thing. So in the police, I was an overfeeler. And it's very difficult to be an overfeeler in the police service. In there, I'm talking about the culture of the 70s now.
Yeah.
So if you had a difficult job, we've all had difficult jobs, painful jobs, you couldn't go and talk about it. It's like, you know, you just didn't. It was not that culture. And I remember people saying, it's too hot in the kitchen, you better get out. So this is culture of not being able to share how you truly felt. And I would drink.
Yes.
And I would drink because my feelings were too intense. Too intense. And I felt I couldn't cope with my feelings. Now, then I'd drink. And then I'd have shame on top of that. The pattern that was emerging for me, which I didn't know at the time, obviously, but the pattern emerging was that I had, all my validation was external. So my job, alcohol, what people thought of me, relationships, the car that I drove, everything was external because I didn't have a sense of who, of core, of who I was, something that was internal. Now, the evidence will show, okay, that I was doing okay in the police and everything, but I had this imposter syndrome inside of me that thought, you know what, Jackie, they're going to catch you out. Another thing was, I was kind of, used to say to the police and stuff, we need to think bigger than we're thinking. And, you know, when I went to Hammersmith, I was told I couldn't go and see the policing unit within the borough of Hammersmith. I said, what do you mean? No, you can't go and speak to them. I said, well, of course you can. Of course we must reach out. And so everything I seemed to bring to the table, they looked at me as if to say, this woman over here, she's rather kind of, you know, odds. But you fight and you fight. And we set up the first domestic violence, no, not the first, the second. The first one's in Tottenham. And the two women that set up the first one in Tottenham, I see three times a year. Three times a year. You know, I still see them socially.
Yeah.
I saw them recently in London. So we set up the second with Hammersmith and Fulham Council. We set up a parallel domestic violence intervention project for the male offenders on parallel lines. So the women got support and the men got support by looking, doing a programme to look at their offending, you know, emotions, behaviours and all of that type of thing. That was in the late 80s. We had a victim liaison officer as well. And, you know, it was a matter of just pushing. But of course, when things get a bit tough and you're down on your numbers, police will always be down on your numbers. The first to collapse then were the victim liaison officer went, you know, domestic violence teams reduced because you've got to be policing somewhere else, if that makes sense.
Uh-huh. Well, you sort of mentioned the power of the institution as well, and there's an intolerance of difference, so I'm just wondering, as you know, as being a gay officer, how that affected your career.
The police when I joined was white, male and heterosexual, and it's intolerance of anybody that was different. Completely intolerance. And the reason was about they didn't understand how other people might act or behave. And I think there's a bit of fear behind, you know, the police and that hierarchy. This is the way that we do things. And we all think the same. And if you start to think outside of the box or you start to think differently, you're labelled as trouble. That was the point. Yeah. You're labelled as the difficult one. And I talk about this and say, never underestimate the power of the institution. It's a phenomenal, powerful, it was then. It's much, much different now. I'd love to be a police officer in some ways in today's police service where you've just got a different feel about leadership. It's just completely different. So we were hierarchical, punitive, disciplined, very powerful institution. And if you, what happened was, if you were seen to be slightly different or speak out, what it brought up for me, this is my stuff, certainly not the police's stuff, was my, again, another dose of shame.
We've just stopped briefly on our walk and we're looking at something, a very interesting structure. What's this we're looking at?
Right, so what happened here is that the electricity board with English Nature, we've got a great manager here called James Giles, and on the common, this beautiful common, we had electricity pylons.
Uh-huh.
And so the electricity board have put all the electricity underground. We have no pylons left on this common. And it's a very famous common for its dragonflies. So what we're looking at now is part of an electricity pylon that they've put into the ground as a remembrance of what it was like.
Yes.
And then we've got this famous, a local blacksmith and his wife designed that beautiful dragonfly.
It's fabulous, isn't it?
Which is what Thursday Common is one of the things that it's famous for. And this is part of what they call the Dragonfly Trail, which I'll just show you here,
uh-huh.
Which gives all the information about the dragonflies and stuff. So,
lovely.
It's just brilliant.
You've made no secret of your alcoholism, and I know mm-hmm. we've spoken about that a little bit. I'm always curious in the two decisions of why couldn't you stop, and then why did you?
Okay, why I couldn't stop, I think, in the sense was that because I became, you know, an alcoholic and it was a need, a physical need to kind of drink. What I would do, I have to say, is I would police myself. So I'd put myself on call as acting, if the acting superintendent was on leave, I'd say, I'll do call. And then I would police myself because I knew that I wouldn't drink, type of thing. And then I'd probably reward, I would reward myself afterwards. And it just became a coping mechanism for my kind of life.
And what was it that you were trying to cope, what was it that you were coping with?
Well, all of this, not feeling enough,
yes.
Shame, imposter syndrome, low self-worth. I just didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. So I was restless. I felt that there was treasure in the trash, that deep down inside of me I knew there was something better and I didn't know how to access it. And I remember being at Kensington and Chelsea, and Alcoholics Anonymous did a presentation to the police consultative group, and I said to them, these alcoholics who were in recovery, how can we the Metropolitan Police help you, you know, shall we put in the ceilings of the cell when you wake up feeling like rubbish, call Alcoholics Anonymous on 0800 123 123 or whatever it was. And this man said to me, why don't you come to a meeting? I said, I'm far too busy.
Yeah.
You know, that grandiosity.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went. And he said, did anything identify with Jackie? And I went, yeah, I can understand it, yeah. I said, I'll just take your, I'll keep your number. Then I read an article in the paper about Danny, who was a homeless man who was on the streets of London, and he woke up one day, had enough, and he didn't want to drink anymore. And he ended up doing the teas and the soup run at Crisis at Christmas. And I thought, I've always wanted to do that Crisis at Christmas. And I just, there's a great saying in AA that you get sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yes.
And I was sick and tired of myself. And I knew, like I said, there was some treasure in the trash. I phoned up that man from AA. It makes me always kind of, it was kind of well up a bit. And he said, oh, do you remember me? My name's Jackie. You know, I was the cop. And he said, yes, I do. And I said, I think I'm one of you. I think I'm an alcoholic. Can you help me? And I said, he said, yes. He came round to my house with another man. I was on the 29th. I went to my first meeting. He took me on the 29th of December 1992. So in a couple of weeks, I'll be 25 years. And he took me to a meeting of AA. And I had shame, huge shame, I thought. Oh, I'd have probably nicked half the people in the room and
yes,
all of that. And grandiosity again. And I over the years, I just, you know, learned that alcohol is just a symptom of other stuff. So I looked at the shame, low self-worth, not feeling enough, Because alcoholics feel that they've never been given. It's and I've spoken to thousands of alcoholics or heard them, and they all say the same. I never felt I'd been given a book of instructions for life. I was always on the edge looking in. I didn't feel part of, I didn't have a sense of belonging, etc., etc. And that was me.
So you're always in the deep end.
Always. In the deep end. And always being, you know, probably looking back at that stuff, being a bit of a rescuer of other people, you know, attracted to the dark side because there was obviously me was in there. And
maybe you're trying to make sense of yourself from other people's stories.
Completely. Completely trying to make sense. So for the next 7 years, I did. Whoever Danny was on the streets of London, I'm grateful to him because I did crisis for 7 years at Christmas on my... I used to do the 27th... No, I did the 28th, 29th, the 30th, and I did the the mobile service where you go out and you take services to people who don't want to go into the centre. And I did that for 7 years on my AA, you know, birthday.
Mm.
So whoever Dan is, just an article in the paper, instigated a change of life in me and phoning AA from meeting them in the police. And I thought, well, I think definitely I'm one of you. And then it's just completely changed my life about a journey of discovery and recovery. You know, I've had therapy, had to do lots of work about me, understand, you know, where it all comes from, about my part in it, the origins of that. And what happens is that you realise that your life is driven by external validation. Now, so Dave would say, oh, Jackie, you're all right. You're all right, mate. Don't worry about it. And I'd go, I'd put the phone down and go, oh, Dave thinks I'm all right. And that'll last 10 minutes because it's Dave validating me, not me.
Yes.
And you learn through the process. So I went to university because I'd failed at 11 plus, and I did that process of going to do 2 masters, one in addiction psychology, which has put me back in the prison to where I always wanted to be when I was 10 or 11, and blah, blah, blah. And that process is that they call it an inside job. So the validation becomes yours because it is yours.
Hmm.
And so the external validation flutters away, and you don't need that. You don't need somebody to tell you you're all right. You don't need that external validation because in your core, you know. Now, it doesn't make you a saint because we're all humans, but you have a program of recovery that says, I felt that my tone wasn't quite right when I spoke to Dave or whatever. Then I have a program that says, do something about it. So I say, Dave, you know, I don't think I really, there's a tone in my voice, or I don't think I was a bit, I might have been a bit sharp with you. You know, you rectify it immediately.
Mm.
And that's the kind of... So you look at your behaviours, your emotions. And what happened was that in the validation process, where I was an over-emoter up here and my rationale was down here, what the programme and the process does, it balances out.
Uh-huh.
So I'm less emotive. I apply more... Well, the equivalent of equal in rationale, much more balanced. I'm much more contained... I don't over-emote. I've got my feet on the ground. But more importantly than anything else, it's like I'm at peace with myself. And when people talk about, you know, AA being a cult or it's God-driven or it's none of those things. It's not a cult. The 12 steps mentions alcohol once and the rest is about your own behaviours. So I have this common here, which I would look at as my higher power because it's nature, nothing to do with man. So I just come out here every day and have my feet on the ground and I look around and I'm at peace. And that's all I ever wanted, Dave. I just wanted to be at peace. And for, I got sober when I was 41, so I'm 66, but between 19 and 41, or before that even, before that, you know, I just felt out of sync, out of place, not part of. I had a foot in the camp and a foot out of the camp. if that makes sense.
Yes.
And so, but your authentic self was driving you about being gay, about having a moral view in the police. So that always would come out of me, and then I would feel shame for having that.
Yes.
And that was the incongruence. Well, why would I feel bad about myself for having those feelings?
I wonder, do you feel angry that you've had to go through all this to find yourself when other people, what I would describe as having a normal life? That...
No, no, not at all. No, I don't feel any anger. No, that was my journey. You know, that's what happened. I'm glad. If somebody said to me, Jackie, I'll give you £1 million for you to be a non-alcoholic tomorrow, or an alcoholic in recovery, I'll take an alcoholic in recovery every day. Because I have... See, it's nothing about alcohol, and that's what people don't think. It's just...
It's a replacement.
It's just a symptom.
Something.
Symptom of other stuff. Shame, fear, low self-worth, not feeling enough. All the kind of aspects of myself that were troubling me. Troubling me. But I knew... deep down in here there was something else, and I just thought, how do I get to it? Well, the 12 steps helps me to do that. And
so the answer you were looking for was within you all the time.
It's always there. Exactly. Yeah. Whatever you're looking for, you've hit it spot on.
Now you've devoted yourself to a lifetime of crime fighting. Probably the most famous part of your career would have been that with the flying squad.
Yeah.
You know, you've lived and breathed work.
Yeah.
I'm interested to know what sacrifices you have made to be a successful police officer.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, that it's just funny when people say to you now, oh, have you got children? You go, no, I'm gay. Well, you can still have them when you're gay. I said, actually, of course you can't. In the 60s and 70s, nobody I knew had children. But I love kids. I love dogs. And kids and dogs seem to love me. So, you know, it was impossible. You just wouldn't have been able to do that. And I'm not saying that's a sacrifice. I'm just saying I'd love to have grandkids and stuff. I love children. I just love them. So I was a workaholic. So obviously my relationship suffered as well. So I gave everything to my work. I gave everything in the sense that you'd go for a drink after work as well. So never home, etc. And I was a blinkered. I was blinkered about kind of the job in lots of ways as well. And I when people had kind of hobbies and everything, I said, well, how boring is that? You know. but I've got loads of hobbies. People used to see people kind of washing their car on a Sunday, just normal. And you think, oh, sad bastards. And everything that I do now that I find is normal. But I was driven, absolutely driven, to do that job, which I have to say is still the best job in the world for anyone, despite, you know, the cuts and everything else. But there's no other job, I don't think, as special as being a police officer. I think whoever's a police officer out there, you're very, very, you know, lucky people. And I know, you know, they are heroes. And there are people that do phenomenal acts of courage and bravery and beyond anything. But that's why we join the job. We join the job to run towards. We didn't join the job to run away from. And what goes with the territory of being a police officer, you do those heroic things. Some people like London Bridge, I mean, phenomenal acts of bravery. Courage, and it's that fight or flight, isn't it?
Yes.
And what the police officer would do, wouldn't even think about it, go whoosh, straight in.
Mm. And how do you think the modern police service is looking after its staff these days?
Well, I'm so impressed. I'm a big follower of Twitter, so that, you know, what you're doing, mental health, well-being. So I went up to Greater Manchester, I did a programme on women in blue, and the woman there was talking about how they're considering what it is for some police officers to care for the elderly, because they've got pressures of caring for the elderly, or they've got children, you know, the sandwich. There are things about how women cope with the menopause. There are things, if you go to traumatic incidents, obviously mental health is very, very important and everything else. So there's lots and lots of support from the police that we never had internally. I think sometimes I think sometimes I just witness a bit of Prozac policing on Twitter, which means that, you know, that is that some senior police officers believe their own narrative when the evidence actually says from other police officers that, you know, it is really, really tough out there.
Yes.
And we're at the front line and we're doing this and we're doing that, and then you've got this kind of Prozac leadership.
It's almost like morale is good on the sixth floor.
Exactly. Morale is good on the sixth floor. So somebody is actually, so there are some ranks there that aren't telling the truth. They're not telling the truth. And what's interesting is why they're not telling the truth. Because it would be perceived, one would guess, that they're being judged. So if I really tell my senior officers, so let's look at superintendent rank. Let's take the superintendent rank.
Yeah.
You know, superintendent rank, so you've got chief superintendent, so you might be going up and then for yourself and everything else. But we need to be, it's no good sitting on your hands as a superintendent and say, well, everything's fine. Mm. I go out with my troops, you know, twice a week on late turn and everything's wonderful. When in actual fact, the evidence will show you that it isn't.
Mm.
And that's what that common language is called, is like Prozac policing. They believe their own narrative.
But is that a symptom of the culture as well? Whereas if they do push a problem up the line, say, look, there are problems, then they think it might reflect badly on them and poor leadership.
It's human. It's human. It's the human condition, isn't it? It's just the human condition. Again, about themselves, about that they will be judged and seen and perceived to be, you know, not, I don't know, it's just like, no, you can't say it's not good because we're into Prozac leadership now and everything's wonderful. Social media helps, and, you know, Twitter helps in lots and lots of ways, but the evidence of the people that are PC sergeant inspectors, chief inspectors will tell you that it's completely, you've only got to read Twitter, haven't you?
Mm.
You know, very, you know, the accounts from mature, responsible police officers will tell you something else. And it's, you know, there's something that's missing. And I mean, I'm not in it, obviously. So I don't know what it is, but I suspect there's a gap of what some, let's say, just for argument's sake, I'm not picking on superintendents, but let's just say superintendent rank may not be saying to the actual reality of the evidence.
So organisational change is very much in the headlines at the moment, and I'm curious as to know how much of that is down to own personal reflection and development.
Well, I do read a lot. I know, I keep going on about Twitter, but I do read a lot about leadership and organisational change and everything else, and it has to come from the, of course, the individual. So you have to integrate the heart and the head. It's not just it's not just using words. So the whole point about any form of change is about reflecting on yourself. So you have to go to the dark parts of you, looking at unconscious biases, your prejudices, what it is that you really think. And are you being authentic, or are you just going with the flow and everything else? So I think it's a lot of hard work to look at yourself. It is hard work because it hurts. And it's painful, so it's easier not to go there. But that is the deep transformational change within you that allows then that you bring back to the organisation to help others and to create that environment where people can be honest, they can show their vulnerabilities, they can tell you who they really are without being judged.
Yes.
Without being, you know, seen as vulnerable, that you have that support system within the organisation that says, I hear you. And so when you go to, for example, an AA meeting, people will tell you their deepest fears. People that have been to the top public schools in the country and have top jobs but are riddled by fear, their insecurities, they don't feel enough, imposter syndrome. And we give them that environment in order to share it with another. So it's a sense of belonging. It's a sense of belonging, not because of the power of the institution, but a sense of belonging because I feel safe, I feel you'll hear me, there is trust, you won't judge me. And that's what I think is what leadership is about, that you can create those forums where people can be truly honest about who they are and share that with other people, and then it enables them to kind of move on and build up their resilience that way.
Well, it's been an absolutely fantastic walk, a fascinating chat with you. Thank you so much for today and for coming on Walk the Talk. I hope you've enjoyed it.
My thanks are all to you and your lovely wife Bev for driving all the way down from Lancashire to Surrey on a cold winter's morning. And I just want to say thank you to you, Dave, for the fantastic work that you do on Twitter, and particularly about mental well-being, and for you to give a forum for a police officer or a retired police officer like me, an old one, who's able to reminisce and talk about my own journey. Now, that's a real gift that you have, that you know, that you find your ministry, and I just want to say thank you to you.
Oh, thank you, and never stop sharing your story.
I won't.